this is like an interlude. It is an interlude. So what I did last time was last time I covered the material that you needed to do the homework to do, compute the period doubling. And I will get to the renormalization group part of it, but partly just so that you have a chance to actually do some of the calculation. I decided today, my guess is this will take sort of half the lecture, to go back and remember on the first day I had said, I talked a little bit about intractable. That again, one of the interesting things of why nonlinear dynamics I think is going to be interesting in the context of game theory is that the concept of equilibrium is intractable. And then I said, how many of you know what I mean by that? And the answer was not very many. Okay, so what I did is I sort of stole some slides that I had, which were introductions to the talk I've given on this. And so it sort of is selected to be things that I think, knowing not very much, would give you some sense of the flavor of computational complexity and what you mean by intractable. Now, there's a whole subject here, all right, in computer science, and there are whole courses on this, and in fact, not just one course, but sequence of courses that one could take. And so this is very much a flavor-giving exercise, as opposed to starting at the beginning, because that would be, a whole course. Okay, but I think it's very useful to have some sense of what people are saying when they're talking about this, because I think it's a really interesting thing. Okay, and so again, the field is called computational complexity. It's a completely well-defined scientific field. It's considered part of computer science. But it turns out that there are some pretty close relations to things that people worry about in physics. Again, most of the connections are through the statistical physics community, but there's quite a bit of activity in it right now. So I think it's really useful for you to hear about it just because it is a area of current interest at the moment. Okay, and so what computational complexity is, again, this is, I'm doing things in a physicist kind of way. I should tell you that computer scientists prove theorems, and so in some sense the language is very similar to mathematics, and so a lot of the challenge is sort of to translate. So this is my best attempt to translate it into language that physicists tend to speak in. Okay. So what you've got is you have a problem that can take on various size, they can have different size. All right, and so the way I actually got into this was I was studying spin glasses, which are magnets. So you did the Ising model when you did statistical mechanics. And so the spin glass is just an Ising model where the signs of the couplings are random. Okay, and it turns out that if you let the couplings be random and not just ferromagnetic, then the problem is much, 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 much harder. Okay, and in particular, there's a problem that one could say is that given a configuration of a spin glass, just, I have a bunch of spins, I have a bunch of couplings, and and they're you choose them at random from, some distribution. What's the ground state of that system? Okay, you're just computing the ground state numerically. Right, and we're used to thinking about, well, if you do it numerically, how hard can it be, right? Okay, however, one can take that problem and say, all right, well, if I have two spins, I can do that, and if I have four spins, I can do that, and, but what happens is you can ask how many computational steps does it take to compute the ground state of that spin glass, and how does that scale with the number of spins? Okay, so that is what you mean when you say, how did the computational resources needed to solve the problem grow with the size of the problem specification? I have a spin glass, I specify the couplings, I specify the number of spins, I specify the lattice, I specify the couplings, and I can do that using computational resources, meaning, writing down the number of numbers that is, set by the number of spins, okay, proportional to the number of spins. Okay, And so then I ask, well, how long does it take for me to compute the ground state energy? Okay, and one of the things that I'm just going to tell you and not really derive in any, I'm just going to tell you and not derive in any systematic way, is that usually when people do this, they talk about the time. Okay, you can also ask, well, how much memory do I need and things like this. But it turns out that's not the critical thing. That the thing that seems to that limit things is the time as opposed to the space. Okay. And essentially, the reason is that if you, I told you I wasn't going to tell you why, but sorry. Okay, the reason is that if you're limited by space, well, then it turns out that, you know, if your time is limited, then you can't even read in from memory, right? So the point is that it turns out that the time limitations translate into space limitations, and so usually you think about the time because time limits space just from the act of reading in from the memory. Okay. All right, so this first thing, which is that, you know, so there are problems, very naturally arising problems in physics that are directly problems in computational complexity, particularly when you're, you know, you have a system and you're doing a numerical simulation, and I can tell you from experience, what happens is you do this thing and I worked on spin glasses for a while, and I had a student, he went away and he, you know, sort of made his system bigger, and then, you know, a few days go by and it hasn't run, and then there was this question, well, how long do you think it would take for this simulation, this computation to end, right? And so, you know, he had done 4, he had done 6, he had done 10, and it turned out when he went to 20, it would have taken the age of the universe, and he never would have graduated. And so, so this is useful to know how things scale with the size. And, you know, and in physics, what we tend to do is we just sort of, we do 4, we do 6, we do 8, we plot on a graph, we then extrapolate, but again, it's a well-defined mathematical problem, how these things scale. Okay, and so then the other thing which the rest of the talk that I'm not going to give you is about is it turns out that problems that come up in the study of computational complexity, the standard problems that I will introduce you to, they exhibit phase transitions. And it turns out that the methods of statistical mechanics are relevant and useful in understanding the behavior of these problems in computer science. So it's actually quite an active area at the moment. Yes? Okay, well, let me, do you mind just holding it, because I will talk very little? Well, no, I mean, I hate that. Oh, if you stay awake for half an hour, then you can't stay awake. Okay, so now I'm going to flip ahead to, okay, so I'm going to introduce you to, like, a standard problem. Okay, and what happens, though, that you can ask, well, how does the time to solve a problem scale with the problem size? But you then can change the problem. You can change the parameters in the problem. And again, I will introduce you to a model in which this happens. And what happens is that there is there's a sort of a range of problems where the time to solve it grows as a polynomial of the system size. And then on the other side, the time to solve the problem grows exponentially with the problem size. And that transition from polynomial to exponential has properties that are like those of a phase transition in statistical mechanics. Okay, and but pretty complicated. Okay, and so it's not simply the same, but the methods of solution are actually very closely related, and it is a phase transition. This going from polynomial to exponential is a phase transition in a well-defined sense. Okay. Which, of course, I'm not going to explain to you, because I'm going to do less than an hour. Okay. But that's sort of the point, that, you know, sort of getting it from this side, at least you know what the words mean. But it turns out there are close relations. Okay. Now, it turns out that there are oodles and oodles and oodles of what are called complexity classes. And I am doing a giant cheat here by just telling you about two of the more famous ones. And they're called P and NP, but there are, I don't know, hundreds of complexity classes that have been defined. But sort of, if you, this again to give you the flavor. Okay, so again and again in my mind, if you want to come in from the physics point of view, you can think of, you know, you've got a system and you're You're minimizing, you're finding the ground state configuration of a system. Okay, but you're doing it numerically, and then you're saying, how does this scale with size? Okay, and so P stands for polynomial. Okay, and the complexity class P is the set of problems that you can solve with polynomially bounded resources. Okay, so again, think of a spin system. You make your system bigger and bigger, and the time to find the ground state grows polynomially. All right, and sort of any calculation that you will do, essentially, is in P, because it's, you know, because in practice, if you know, anytime you can get to the thermodynamic limits, or you know, in practice, it's in P. Just because exponentials grow really, really fast. Okay, you know, so say you have a 10 by 10 system, right? And sort of you just say, well, okay, it's 100 some power, and you can have a pretty big power, and you know, you have a gigahertz processor, and you can do pretty well. But you know, 2 to the 100 is actually quite giant number, and 2 to the 200 is even more giant. And I think 2 to the 100 is if you I forget, but it's like the age of the universe is 10 to the 11 seconds, something like that. Anyway, the point is, very quickly, you know, if things are exponential, you can't do anything with them. Okay, so NP, does not stand for not polynomial. Okay, NP, the N, and again, this is true for complexity classes in general, stands for non-deterministic. Okay, so NP is actually not a particularly hard complexity class. It's easy in the sense that a problem in NP, if someone gave you the answer, you can verify that it's the right answer in a polynomial number of steps. Okay, and so in that sense, it's a simple problem. Okay. And I'll give you an example of, you know, a standard thing in a minute. The spin glass turns out to be an NP, but it's not completely obvious that if someone gave you the ground state, you could verify it in a polynomial step, polynomial number step. So it turns out it's true, but it's not completely obvious. But the one I'll show you in a minute is that way, where you can confirm that you have a solution in a polynomial number of steps. And the question is, and in some sense, you know, it's a very fundamental question, is it harder to find the answer than it is to check that it's the right one? And then now our intuition is, well, yeah, sure, you know, someone tells you the answer and then you can check it's right, you know, it doesn't mean it's easy to find the answer. And it turns out that, you know, huge amounts of commerce and you know, sort of anything that happens financially on the internet or whatever is based on the fact that, you know, according to this intuition, that, you know, even if you can check that the answer is the right answer in polynomial time, it doesn't mean you can find the answer is the right answer in polynomial time. Okay. And again, what's happened is that we say, okay, if the problem is in P, meaning you can solve it in, you know, time that scales polynomially with the size of the system, that that's what we call tractable, okay? And it's not completely obvious that there's a clean separation, but in practice, it's surprisingly good. The problems that in P tend to have power, the time to solve grows at powers that are not enormous, and so if they're in P, they're essentially easy to solve, and if they're in NP, we don't know how to solve them, and we think, but we don't know, that that there are problems in NP that cannot be solved in polynomial time, but that is not known. Okay, and again, this turns out to be one of the Clay Institute questions. And it's one of seven, and one's been solved. But you know, again, it's in some sense one of the easier ones to explain. And just to give you an idea, there was actually a market for P versus NP, which ended. And so it's sort of, you know, so it is no longer in the market. The price went to zero. Okay, so the problem was posed in 1971. Okay, and again, it was because computer science is not as old a field as some other fields, and you know, and just the fact that it's still open, but then you can sort of see it's still open. And I'd say what's happened in the meantime, and which I really won't give you too much of a sense about, but if you want, I can, because I think this is a very interesting field, is it's become clear why it's really hard. but again, at this moment, there's no, you know, the zero is for not just that it wasn't solved by last week, but also there's no clear path to solving the problem. Okay. But why is it interesting? I mean, there are lots of things that you can't solve that are fundamentally uninteresting, but it turns out you can say a lot. Okay. And so one of the things is, and this is sort of what the purpose of this lecture is, to give you some sense of the complexity classes and why they're entities and why they're worth thinking about. Okay, that they have sort of a sense in which they're natural things to define. Okay, and that's what this is going to be about. Now, so what I'm going to do is introduce you to sort of the fruit fly of P and NP and whatever, which makes it, this is a problem, it's a very standard problem, and it sort of illustrates why there's sort of a naturalness to these definitions that leads one to think that there's something really fundamental there. Okay, so the problem I'm going to introduce you to is called satisfiability. I know you know what satisfiability, who has seen this stuff? One, two. Okay, so few enough that you will be hopefully grooving on the fact that you know everything that I'm saying. Okay. All right. So here's the definition. Okay. But actually, let me not do the definition first. Let me do the example, because one of the things that's difficult when you're doing this is sort of the style of a presentation is very much abstract definition, and then you have no idea what it's about, and then the example's at the end. So I will do the physicist thing of doing the example first, and then we'll go back to the definition. Okay, so I had a computer scientist tell me that he was so excited about this example because it's the first one that's actually precisely satisfiability. Okay, so it's not even like closely related or a different problem that's also NP complete, but it's actually satisfiability. Okay, so here's the example. So the setup is that you are the Rolling Stones, okay, and you have a list of songs, okay, and you had to pick a band that had like a lot of songs, because again, the thing which is what you're trying to do is scale, the number of songs. All right, and the idea is then you have a bunch of people in the audience, and everybody has a criterion for whether he or she will be satisfied, okay. And you say, okay, well, I really want to hear Start Me Up, or I really don't want to hear Angie, okay? And so what happens is that everybody, and the rule is that everybody has sort of three things, like a song they really want to hear, and if they hear that song, they're happy, or a song they really don't want to hear, and if they don't hear that song, they're happy. So it's like, if I hear Start Me Up, I'm happy, or if I hear Brown Sugar, I'm happy, but if I don't hear Angie, I'll be happy, and that person goes away happy, okay? And so then the question is, and then everybody has three things that they're allowed to want. All right, and so then the question is, can they make a playlist where everybody has at least one thing that makes them happy? Okay, that's the setup. Okay, and so here is the definition. Okay, and so it's called KSAT here. K, and again, this is just sort of what I'm just going through what the standard notation is. So K is the number of possible ways that each person could be made happy. Okay, you know, so in the case that I did, it's like there were three things. It was either they could play Start Me Up, play Brown Sugar, or not play Angie. There were three. And so for the example I did, K is three. Okay, and then N is the number of songs. Okay, and the point is that either the band plays a song or doesn't play a song. okay? So they could either play start me up or not play start me up. And if they play start me up, then that variable is 1, and if they don't, it's 0, okay? And then M clauses, the clause is each person. Each person has three things that, you know, if one of those three things happens, they're happy, but then M is the number of people in the audience, okay? And so then again, so each person has three things that if any of them happen, they're happy. So that's the disjunction of K literals. That's the choice of things that they want to have happen. And again, that's a condition that they either play a song or not play a song. And then you say, is there a playlist, an assignment of the variables, for which every person has something happen on their list of things that would make them satisfied? Okay, that's satisfiability, okay? And so here is, again, now in, you know, mathematical language, say, well, I have variables x1, x2, x2. So, you know, here, they played brown sugar, they didn't play start me up, and they did play Angie, et cetera, et cetera. And is there a playlist that works? And again, this one, this is a satisfiable expression because if I set x1 is true, x2 is true, x3 is false, then it works, okay? Both clauses are satisfied. Okay. So this is the thing where now the size of the problem, again, is the, you know, you just specify the n variables, the m clauses, and that's the size of the problem, and then you wonder how long does it take to decide whether there's a assignment that works. Okay. And so then again, the question is how long does it take to solve? Okay. And again, the answer to that question is we don't know. Okay? However, what's happened is that there are a bunch of problems that are all equally hard. Okay? And this is where the significance of the computational complexity class comes from. Okay? That you say, well, all right, well, that's a problem, but then there are other, you know, other problems that I could see whether, there was one other thing I forgot to say about satisfiability, which is, I think I say it later, but I should say it here, is that if you come up with a playlist that works, then you can check it in polynomial time. You just check it and you plug it into all the clauses. You have a candidate solution, you plug it into all the clauses, and you see if they're all satisfied, and if it is, you're done. Okay, so it's a sense where you don't know how you came, and so basically you just, you know, somebody just hands you this playlist. You have no idea how they came up with it, but given the playlist, you can check the solution in linear time. You just check every clause. Okay, all right, I forgot to say that. Okay, so, but now there's this question of, you know, well, why a complexity? Why is it a class? All right, and so what happens is that, again. So there are easy problems in NP. I mean, all the problems that you can find the solution in polynomial time, you can also check the solution in polynomial time, right? Okay, but the point is that there are problems that we don't know how to solve in polynomial time, and we don't know how long it takes to solve them, but we can prove that if you can solve one, you can solve them all, okay? And basically, that's the notion of NP completeness. And Cook wrote a famous paper in 1971, and this was the thing that turned this into, you know, a clearly relevant concept that, you know, it had some real significance, you know, that clearly was sort of fundamental to understanding how hard problems are. Okay, so an NP complete problem is a problem that is in NP, but is the hardest problem in NP in the sense that if you could solve it in polynomial time, you could solve any problem in NP in polynomial time, okay? And it's even stronger than just the statement that if one problem is in, you know, if you could solve if this problem is in P, they're all in P. You actually get an algorithm, and actually the algorithm for solving any NP complete problem can be you can basically put a front end onto it to actually solve any problem in NP. So it's sort of they're fundamental problems in NP in the sense that, you know, if you could solve any problem in this class, if you could solve in polynomial time, it actually provides an algorithm for solving every problem in NP. Okay, and part of the significance of satisfiability is that the three-sat is the first problem that was shown to be NP complete. Okay, So, okay, and so now what I have, and now in the meantime, many, many problems have been shown to be NP-complete. And so that's sort of what gives the notion real heft, is the fact that there, you know, that there's sort of all these things are sort of equivalently difficult, and that's why it's a, you know, complexity class, okay? Okay, and many famous problems are known to be NP-complete, and again, you can map each of them into all the others, and you can map any problem in NP onto any of these problems. And there's thousands of NP-complete problems. Okay, all right. So, but what I want to do is to just give you some sense of how this works. Okay, and then I was going to give you another little bit of sense of sort of this transition between, you know, what we know as polynomial and what we think is exponential. Okay, so this is my one slide rendition of Cook's argument of why 3-sat is NP-complete. Okay, so the first step is really easy, and I already told you, okay, just because I realized that I needed to tell you before, which is that, again, if someone were to hand you the solution, you can check it's correct in polynomial time. Again, because you have assignment for the variables, you have, you know, n variables, and you have m clauses, and n and m are proportional in this sort of picture, and then you just, you know, so they give you polynomially many numbers, and then you just plug into every clause, and so you just see if they're all true, you're done. Okay, so it's an NP. Okay, okay, because again, NP is the ability to check. It's not the ability to find. It's the ability to check. Okay, so but now is the tricky part. You say, okay, well, all right, but how do I show it's NP complete? Okay, and so Cook's great insight is, he said, well, think about the computer program that checks it, okay, and basically you think about your computer, and you say, okay, well, this bit's in this state, and this bit's in this state, and this bit's in this state, and so he said, well, okay, given that, you say, well, then, you know, you can write a satisfiability expression for the state of the computer at every time step, all right? Which is not in the canonical form. The form I showed you is this thing called disjunctive normal form. It turns out the form is not disjunctive normal form, okay? But you can do it. You say, well, you know, bit A has to be in, you know, has to be in this thing, and bit B. So you can do it in terms of ands, right? And bit B tends to be in the state, and bit C has to be in the state. Okay, that has to happen. And at the next step, something has to happen. And then sort of the non-trivial part that I will not show you at all is you can then convert that into the form that I was showing, you know, the form I showed you. And you can, and then, of course, the size of the expressions is polynomial but isn't 3. But then it turns out there is a well-defined transformation that you can do that takes all these long clauses, and you can divide, then basically you can write them as they're equivalent to a polynomial number of 3 clauses. Okay, so what you do is you basically just take the computer program itself that you use to verify the solution for whatever problem you're looking at, and you can convert that into a polynomially large satisfiability expression. Okay, and so that shows you that, you know, and that's the what's called the reduction of any problem in NP to satisfiability.
That runs in P can be hardwired as, like, you know, something made of set clauses.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's essentially the key insight. Is you actually take the program you use to verify the solution, and then you can translate that with a polynomial overhead into set clauses. Okay. So the point is that, you know, any problem, if you can solve satisfiability in polynomial time, then you can take any problem, and then, you know, and you can convert it to satisfiability. So therefore, if you have an algorithm to solve satisfiability, you just take that front end, you put it in, you can solve any problem in NP. Okay? So, and then what happens is, you know, then what you can do is you can take satisfiability and show that you can convert it into an instance of the traveling salesman problem, okay? And so that means if you have an algorithm that solves a traveling salesman problem, you can have a polynomial overhead, you know, solve satisfiability, and then polynomial overhead, you can solve anything. So with any of these problems that are NP-complete, if you can solve one, you can solve them all, and if you can solve, you know, and so that's the sense in which all these problems are equivalent. Okay, and this idea of having lots and lots of different specific implementations or different specific problems that are all fundamentally the same problem, even though they all look different, I mean, that's the sense in which it's extremely reminiscent of the concept of universality in physics, right? Because in physics, we have like all these different Hamiltonians, all these different spin Hamiltonians that are different at the microscopic level, but all in the renormalization group sense flow into the same Hamiltonian. Is very similar. It's very similar concept. Okay, but in physics, we just have a much better fundamental understanding of one another. So here, you can see that they're all equivalent. But again, you can't even show. You mean nobody can show that they're fundamentally different than a problem that is impeding. Okay, so the last thing I was going to do, and again, I thought this would take 10 minutes, but sorry. Okay, the last thing I want to do is to give you some sense of, well, how do you show problem is impeding as opposed to NP-complete? See, because again, NP-complete, you do this sort of thing where you take once you have satisfiability worked out, basically you take satisfiability and then you convert that into whatever problem, and if you can do that, you can show that that other problem is NP-complete too. Because again, if you could solve it, then you could solve satisfiability. If you can solve satisfiability, you can solve anything in NP. Okay, all right. But and here's sort of the problem, which I think will help in terms of giving you an idea of why. There's sort of this disconnect between showing things are hard and showing things are easy. Okay, so the way you show things are hard, and again, you don't really show they're hard. You show they're as hard as this other thing that you think is also hard. Okay, so you show things are sort of in a particular class, but to show they're easy, all you got to do is you got to make an algorithm that solves it. Okay, and so TuSat, which again is the same thing. That I've been talking about, except that instead of having clauses that are of length 3 or greater, the clauses are of length 2, it is in P. Okay, you can solve that in polynomial time. But the way you show that you solve it in polynomial time is to actually solve it in polynomial time. You actually write down a program that solves the problem in polynomial time. Okay. And so now, finally, to get back to your question, who asked about the phase transition? Okay. So finally, get back to your question, what happens is that you can say, all right, well, between 2 and 3, it goes from polynomial to, we think, x, or, I mean, the way they've been working this, because again, sort of at the rigorous level, the results are sort of nil. They take votes among computer scientists of, whether they think P is not equal to NP. And so you can go back and it's sort of interesting because it's sort of like, I don't know. Do we do this in physics, really? Yeah, we do, but not as officially, right? So, 85% of computer scientists in these votes say that P is not equal to NP, and essentially, and the people who vote for P equal NP say, well, we've been working so hard to prove that it hasn't, and that they're not equal, and we're failing, so maybe we're wrong, and maybe they are the same. Anyway, but that's I'm not telling them short because there's like wonderful stuff. But again, it's sort of interesting. If you want, I can tell you a little bit about things that failed. Okay, really interesting approaches to P versus NP that turned out not to be good. Anyway, but here, so again on the TuSat, there's an algorithm. Okay, so I'll just run through the algorithm just because again I think it's useful to see how these guys think. And okay, so what they did is they took TuSat and they mapped it into a problem that's called graph reachability. Okay, and so basically they're going to make a graph out of TuSat. Okay, and so again, what happens again? It's mapped onto another problem that is sort of obviously in P, and there you are. Okay, so the vertices of the graph are the variables and their negations. So the bar is not x1. Okay, so. Okay, and then basically, if you have TuSat, then what happens is, okay, you can sort of say, all right, I can take the clause, which says that either x1 is true or x2 is true, and I can translate that into a graph, a statement about a graph. Okay, so if x2 is false, okay, I'm looking at this thing. If x2 is false, that means x1 must be true, or else that clause isn't satisfying. Okay, and if x1 is false, then x2 must be true, or else this clause isn't satisfied. Okay, so what you do is you take the clause and then you turn it into links on a directed graph. Okay, and the trick is going to be that there are a series of implications, and we're going to follow these links around. And if it turns out that you can make a closed loop that x1 must be false and also true at the same time, then it's not satisfiable. Where if it is satisfiable, then you just follow the implications until you hit the end of an arrow. Okay. But what will happen is that at some point you won't be able to hit the end of an arrow anymore. You'll go in a loop, and then, you know, because basically you take a random assignment of the variables, and then you say, oh, okay, well, it's random, and clearly not everything's going to work. And you say, well, what do I need to make it work? And again, here I said, well, okay, my random assignment made x2 false, so I'll just turn x2 to true. I'll make x1 true, and then that clause is okay. And as long as the end of my arrow, you know, as long as the arrows end, I'll find a satisfying assignment. And if the arrows don't end, then I go in a loop, then, you know, and it never works, right? So that's sort of the point. So now I have this fabulous animation. Okay, and so here's another one where, like, if x1 is true, then x2 must be true, right? Okay, and so there's the line, right? X1 is true, and therefore that means that x2 must be true. So again, I take my random assignment and I say, well, okay, I made x2 false, and if x2 is false, then x1 is true. But now x1 is true, but that means, well, then that second clause has a problem, but I can still go down here, and I'm still good, right? So if I set, you know, x2 true and x1 false, I'm still good. You see what I mean? Okay, so I can keep going that way, and eventually I run into a situation. Did I run into it already? I think I did. Let's see. Two is false. Well, I'm going to cheat and just go down. No, there. Okay. Yeah. So what happens here, okay, so I say, well, all right, well, I have some random assignment here. X2 is false, okay, and that's no good, right? In order for X2 to be false and for everything to work, X1 has to be true, because that's what the first clause says, okay? Okay, but if X1 is true, then X2 must be true, okay? And then you say, well, all right, because that's what the second clause says, okay? And you say, oh, okay, well, okay, but if X2 is true, then X1 has to be false, okay? And that's because of the blue one here, right? Okay, and then you say, and you get the idea, but then you just keep going around and around, and then it never works. Okay, and so, okay, so that's sort of that's the mapping. Okay, is it clear why the mapping works? Okay, So then the point is, though, so what you're asking is, you know, do I have a closed loop that goes from a variable, you know, through it to its negation and then back to the variable? Is there a loop on a graph? And it turns out that it's sort of easy to see that you can do that in polynomial time. Okay. But again, that's a separate thing. But there were known algorithms for doing this. But it's sort of completely plausible that I say, well, I just follow this thing along and see whether I get back to it, you know, see whether it comes back to itself. And if it does, then you're sunk. Okay. And it turns out you can do it in linear time. This turns out to take the square, but all right. Okay. And so what that said is that, you know, and again, why I went through this was to just give you a sense that part of the difficulty is sort of the way you show things are in P. It's so different than the way you show that they're in NP, you know, that they're NP complete, and sort of that show figuring out what the boundary is so difficult, just because the styles of argument are so different. Okay, that was all I was going to say. Oh no, it isn't. This is a summary of what I did, but I was going to say a little more about why it's relevant to what I'm going to say later in the course, which I guess is a useful thing to know. Okay, and so again, the point of computational complexity is you're trying to understand how the computational resources required to solve a problem scale with the size of the problem. And complexity, and the whole point of this was to sort of give you some sense of why complexity classes sort of natural, useful things. And again, it's because they're sets of problems that are of equivalent difficulty in a well-defined sense. Okay, and then I did P versus NP partly because they're the most famous complexity classes, but also because I wanted to do this sort of game theory stuff, and it turns out that this is sort of the complexity classes are relevant to game theory or sort of in this class also related to this class. But there are lots of other complexity classes, and so there's like things of exponential time, and there's p-space, and you know, so how many, I mean, there's this thing called the complexity zoo, and I forget, there are like several hundred complexity classes of various types. Okay. So I did want to do one more thing in the time available, which is to talk about the complexity class that's going to be relevant for Nash equilibrium. Okay, and so I looked up the name of the thing. It's called PPAD. Okay, essentially, this is a complexity class that was actually just sort of cooked up. And that's the thing about complexity classes is there are lots of different complexity classes that you can cook up. It's cooked up about, I think, in 1993 or so. And for a particular problem on graphs, okay? And but then it turns out that more recently, like just in the last 2 years, it turns out that this complexity class has been proven to be the one that's relevant for the difficulty of Nash equilibrium. Okay, so again, it was cooked up in a different context, but because it's relevant to Nash equilibrium, then it becomes a much more natural-sounding complexity class. You know what I mean? Because there's a natural problem that came up in another context that many people are interested in, and it turns out to be the same as some other problem that came up in a different context. So let me give you just the little summary of what the class was. And essentially what it is you've got a problem. Again, the solution can be verified efficiently, so it's in NP. And you don't know how to find the solution, but the difference between it and a typical NP problem is you know there is one, okay? But that's all you know. You have what they call a non-constructive proof that a solution must exist. Okay, and so then the question is, does the fact that you know that a solution exists useful information in solving the problem? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, actually, PPAD is defined in terms of the problem. This is a big, in terms of this problem. Okay. This is a complexity class for which this problem, which I have right here, is a complete problem. Okay. And then it was proven that, you know, if you could find a Nash equilibrium, you could solve this problem also. And so now all of a sudden it's a complexity class with more than one natural complete problem. Yeah.
Is equivalent to being in PPAD?
No.
Okay.
It may be, but I don't think that's because again, I don't know all the different ways you can be proven not to have a solution. But I did go through the proof, and the proof is specific for Nash equilibrium problem. Okay. You take a graph problem and then you sort of turn it into a problem that is finding the Nash equilibrium of some game, right? Okay, so it uses the specific problems at hand, but it is not known whether all things for which you have a non-constructive proof of a solution is it's not known whether they're all equivalent. Okay, in fact, I'm pretty sure they're not. Okay, but I don't think that's really known. See again. Because we don't even know if P is not equal to NP. Well, and it's worse than that. We don't even know if P is equal to P space, okay? So for instance, there are many problems you can go for, which actually take exponential time to take polynomially bounded space. And it's not even known whether P and P space are not the same. So what happens is that, if you have two things like this, you say, well, they could be different. It's not known whether they're different or the same. Because essentially nothing, well, not nothing, but the set of classes that have not been proven to be distinct is just so broad that, you know, the answer to your question is very safely, I don't know. You see what I mean? But they haven't been proven to be the same, but we don't know that they're different. You see what I'm talking about? Okay. And again, if you don't know P is equal to P space, it's a level of granularity that you're not going to hit. Okay? All right. So here's the first example, all right? And again, this was cooked up about 15 years ago. And so basically the point is that he takes a directed graph, okay? And he makes this rule that, you know, so a graph is, you know, just a bunch of vertices and edges, okay? And he makes a rule that any vertex can, it's a directed graph, so the things have arrows. That was why I did that directed graph thing, so, you know, okay. You know, and so here's a vertex, right? And what happens is that, you know, that you have it where every vertex cannot have more than one ingoing or outgoing arrow. Okay, so like an allowed graph looks like this. Okay. This one is ingoing. So I could go all the way around, or I could do things that did this, okay. But the relevant, where it has disconnected pieces, say, okay. But the relevant thing is actually I've got a thing that looks like this, okay? All right. And so the point is that you have a situation where somebody gives you a graph with the connections, and then also tells you, like, this vertex doesn't have an outgoing edge, okay? They tell you that this vertex doesn't, okay? Well, and it looks easy to solve, but okay, hopefully you can, all right. And just through the miracle of, you know, everything that starts has to have an end, if there's a vertex that doesn't have an incoming edge, there must be another vertex that doesn't have an outgoing edge, okay? And your problem is to find the vertex that doesn't have a this doesn't have an outgoing edge, sorry. And so but obviously I could flip it, right? I could just change the sign with all the arrows, right? So they tell you the one that doesn't have an outgoing edge, and your job is to find the vertex that doesn't have the incoming edge, okay? And you know there must be one, right? Because because you can easily verify, because again, this is NP, so all of this has to do with verification. You can easily verify that, you know, this guy doesn't have an outgoing edge because, you know, they have a list of, you know, everything's connected to what, okay? But, and again, you could have, like, this total list. So you know there must be, you know, that there's like, you can think of it as, like, okay, there's the guy that this would have connected to, and, you know, and through the miracle of you know, odd and even numbers being the way they are, if you're missing one outgoing edge, you must be missing an incoming edge on some other vertex, but that's all you know, okay? And so the question is, so the question is, how do you find it? It's up by going through all the edges. Is there some efficient way of finding it? And you know, and again, we don't know. We don't think so. You know, we can't think of an efficient way, but okay. And so what makes it sort of interesting is that which I didn't do, but I have 2 minutes, so I can tell you, is it's sort of obvious, well, it's not obvious, because again, nothing's obvious here, but it is not believed that problems that are this way, you know, you have this promise of a solution. Again, you have some other way of proving there's a non-constructive way, right? Because you count, you know there must be, you know, a guy hanging out somewhere, but that's all you know. You don't know where it is. You don't have an algorithm. It's a non-constructive proof of existence. Okay. And so the question is, does that tell you something? Okay. And what happens is that, you know, and this is what Papa Dimitriou, who came up with this problem, pointed out, is that such problems are extremely unlikely to be NP complete. Okay. So here's the argument. This is sort of for the cognoscenti, But the point is that because it turns out, because you know a solution exists, if you were to guess the right solution for this problem, it turns out that that would provide an efficient way of proving that no solution exists for an NP-complete problem. Okay, and so going back to satisfiability, you know, I had this thing where you could say, well, if the Rolling Stones were to send you their playlist and you checked it was true, you can do that in polynomial time. But how do you know that no solution exists, okay? And again, it is not believed there's an efficient way of knowing. I mean, you can try a solution and say, well, it didn't work, right? But you don't know that somewhere or other there is a solution hanging out there somewhere, right? So it is believed that, you know, and if P is not equal to NP, then there's a class called co-NP, which is the, you know, to show that there's no solution to an NP-complete problem. Okay, so if this was NP-complete, then NP would be equal to co-NP, and so proving something doesn't exist would be just as easy as checking that it existed. So because of that, they don't think that this is NP-complete. However, okay, it turns out that, you know, it looks like it's really hard to solve. Okay, and so again, it's sort of an interesting complexity class for that reason. It appears to be distinct from NP-completeness. But also, it's interesting because all of a sudden there's this very natural Nash equilibrium problem that is in the class and is complete for the class and has a lot of relevance in economics and other things. Okay, and so again, that's why I wanted to introduce you to this. And again, a lot of these questions are really open and very active in computer science right now. But I think that because of this difficulty of finding the equilibrium, the question of understanding what the dynamics have to say, because it means that, you know, it's not a question of you just find the equilibrium state and know you reach it. What happens, it's very much like a glass problem, like, you know, in the spin glass problem its own, that, you know, finding the ground state of a spin glass tells you nothing, actually, about what the behavior of a spin glass is, because the system never finds the state because it takes exponentially long time to find. So the same thing is going to be happening in game theory. And again, it's only recently that this has become clear. Because again, people said, well, we know Nash equilibrium exists, so let's just study Nash equilibrium. But it turns out that we now know that that is too simplistic. You see what I mean? Just like in a spin glass, we know that it has a ground state. But we also know that the fact that it has a ground state is sort of irrelevant to understanding the physics of what's going on. OK, so I thought that was going to take half an hour, but I took a whole hour. But okay, so next time, you will have had a chance to fool around or whatever with the period doubling, and you'll see do the scaling. I wanted to, you know, have you sort of see the scaling for yourself. And then next time, I'll do the renormalization group for the maps. Okay, so I'll go back to the main thread tomorrow, and we'll start on the renormalization group. And again, the point being, once you see the scaling, to see that you can actually compute the exponents without simulating the map is, you know, that's what I'm going to do tomorrow. Okay? Okay.